Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. God of grace, we open our hearts, minds, and souls to worship you. Thank you that today we dwell in your kingdom and live in your presence. Thank you that as we gather together, we join with all Christians across the world to glorify your holy name. Come be with us, inspire us, and lead us in our time together. We ask all of this in your beautiful name. Amen.
Amen.
Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen. Okay, so just a quick recap. I think most of you were here last time, but a quick recap for last time, because I wanted to clarify. We went through, there were three different views that you could adopt with respect to putting Genesis or a doctrine of creation together with the scientific data. And I tried to emphasize that those three views were legitimate, at least theologically. So those three views, again, were the young earth creationist view, the progressive creationist view, and then the evolutionary creationist view. I want to make it clear, though, because I don't think this was super clear to everybody, that I did not mean to say that all three of these views are equally scientifically legitimate. I really don't think that they are equally scientifically legitimate. And I'm also not trying to say that they're equally legitimate all things considered, meaning considering all of the evidence, not just scientific, but philosophical, theological, putting everything together. I'm not trying to argue that they are on equal footing. I mean, by the very fact that I strongly prefer one, it should be obvious that I don't think they are on exactly equal footing. But I did want to highlight at least that, strictly theologically speaking, all three are legitimate. So if you were just restricted to looking at the theological data, and you couldn't help yourself to scientific evidence or philosophical argument or things like that that fall outside of the bounds of theology, I think you have to regard all three of those views as legitimate. So that was maybe the most important takeaway from last time. And I'm afraid that some people might have taken away that all three views are equally plausible or something like that. I don't think that is. I don't want to say what I think everyone's view should be. I think it's better for people to just engage the three different views, engage the arguments, and then see what they think is most plausible for themselves. But the important note was just to say that all three of them are theologically within the wheelhouse of good Orthodox Christian theology. And then the other thing we saw, which I'm still going to follow up with resources on, was that there, at first glance, it looks like there are these tensions between evolutionary theory in particular and Christianity. And I think that most, if not all, of those tensions can actually just be alleviated. They're not serious or insuperable problems. But there's actually a deeper, more serious problem for the naturalist. That if the naturalist wants to adopt evolution, they've actually got a defeater for naturalism in a much more severe sense than evolution provides any kind of defeater for Christian theology. So that was basically what we did last time. This time, I was actually debating about whether we should do like a whole session on this topic, but I think it is still worth doing because we're touching Genesis anyways. So today, we're going to try to touch Genesis more theologically and scripturally, in a sense, and not so much in the sense of taking a step back and looking at what different theological views you could adopt, but actually looking at Genesis itself. So you had mentioned, for example, that you were interested in the parallels between Genesis and the Enuma Elish. There are, in fact, some significant parallels, not only between Genesis and the Enuma Elish, but between Genesis and other ancient Near Eastern writings that are often categorized as myth. And there are a few things here that I think, okay, so there are differences between the way that like academics talk about these things and the way that people in the pews or on the streets talk about these things. One of the key differences is that when people in academia use the term myth, they do not mean untrue story, or that it's not factual, or that it's in any sense untrue. And that's something that people don't usually, that it catches them off guard, because usually when you hear somebody say something is a myth, you think, well, it's not true. That's what you mean by saying that it's a myth. That is absolutely not what academics mean, and certainly not in either religious studies or theology, which are different, but the term really gets used, this the the way that academics use it, it gets used this way from religious studies, where people wanted a way to study religions without making any statements about whether a religion was true or whether a religion is more plausible than other religions. Just take a step back and imagine that all religions are on equal footing, right? It's a kind of relativist view of religion. If it's not real relativism, it's at least something like methodological relativism. You just assume that even if one religion looks better than another, it looks more plausible, you can't say it as a scholar, right? That's the approach of a lot of religious studies. So they'll use a term myth to talk about origin story or creation story, some kind of story that situates, explains not only the existence of everything around you, other people groups, the earth, the stars, the whole cosmos, and then situates you and your people in it. Right? That's, they wanted a way to categorize literature that is about that or that does that. And so they said, well, let's call that myth, because that seems like the best term that we have for describing this kind of overarching narrative of origins, something like that. But when they use the term myth, there's no assumption that it's untrue or that it's, you know, that it's a suspect or anything like that. What they mean is just it fits into this kind of literary category. Just like there's poetic literature in the scripture, just like there's apocalyptic literature, just like there's historic literature, myth is like a genre of literature. And if you want to understand what myth does, then you have to understand the way in which myth communicates. Just like if you want to understand apocalyptic literature, right? If you were to read the book of Revelation, and it describes a dragon coming out of the sea, and then, okay, if you take that literally, you will not understand what the author of Revelation is actually trying to say. And you have to be attuned to the way in which apocalyptic literature works, the kind of idioms that it uses, the kind of imagery that it uses, and things that are taken for granted that the author never explains. They just assume that their audience will already know what that image really means, right? Myth works arguably in a very similar way. It uses a lot of imagery that people are supposed to kind of know, takes it for granted. But that means that what myth is trying to tell you is not necessarily what you would read in the most literalist of fashion. Just like what apocalyptic literature is trying to tell you is not what it looks like in the most literal reading it might be trying to tell you. So there are religious studies scholars who will say the proper way to categorize Genesis is as myth, but that's the kind of literature that it is. Now, there are some arguments for this view, and it is somewhat attractive in some ways, but you'll notice that if you take a step back and think about those three different categories last time, young earth creationists in particular, they're going to argue that Genesis is probably better understood as historic literature, not mythic literature, that what it tells you is more or less straightforwardly true historically, and it's intended to be taken as historical information. So my point here is just to say how you're going to interpret Genesis is in large measure going to depend on how you answer this question of, well, what even is Genesis? What kind of literature does it fall into? Is it poetic literature? Is it apocalyptic? Is it historic? Is it mythic? And I actually think that this is something that's an open debate. Again, anyone can take a number of different views. I mean, it's clearly not poetic, so nobody should take that view, but it could be historic, it could be mythic, and so on. I think that certainly for the first chunk of Genesis, chapters 1 through to 11, I think that the proper category for that section of Genesis should just be referred to as what some scholars call mytho-history. So it is using mythic literature, and you can tell that it's using it in part by looking at the obvious parallels that it has with other ancient Near Eastern myths. So for example, in the Enuma Elish, it talks about how the waters are separated from top to bottom. There's a kind of dome of the sky, and there are the waters below, and then the earth between. Okay, well, that looks very, very similar to what you see in Genesis, where God separates the waters and creates the dome in the sky and so on. So those are similarities that look like they're more than just coincidental, right? No, one of these, or both of them, have a similar origin. Now, it used to be thought that Genesis was taking a lot from the Enuma Elish. This is, yeah, sorry.
What is that word that you're saying?
Enuma Elish? So the Enuma Elish, if you look it up online, you'll find that this is an ancient Babylonian creation myth, and it outlines something similar in many ways, in many striking ways, to what you find in Genesis. But it's clearly a more polytheistic creation narrative, and there are some striking similarities between it and Genesis. And people have wondered, well, given that these are similar, what are we supposed to do with that similarity? So some people have thought, well, maybe Genesis is really just, you know, plagiarizing off of the Enuma Elish, because there are all these strange similarities between them. But part of that, I mean, most scholars have now kind of left that behind, because they've realized that, first of all, ancient Babylonians didn't have that much influence, cultural and otherwise, over surrounding peoples. They had some influence, surely, but they didn't have that much overriding influence. But then also, the dates for the account in Genesis and the dates for the Enuma Elish have shifted over time. At least scholarly consensus has shifted them over time. And now, which one you came first is actually going to depend on which arguments you buy from which scholars. So it could be that one of them comes significantly earlier, it could be that it's actually not that much earlier. And so those two factors, one that the ancient Babylonians weren't actually that influential to surrounding cultures, and second, that it's not even clear which one comes first, and even if the Enuma Elish came first, how long before it did it come. And there are some of the similarities that they share that are shared with other ancient Near Eastern myths as well. And so clearly there's a kind of typical ancient Near Eastern way of thinking about the world that just figures in mythic literature, just like there was a kind of way of thinking that figures in apocalyptic literature. So those are, but a lot of people took those to be, I think some people take that to be a kind of challenge to their faith, right? So if it looks like the Enuma Elish came first, and then the Bible is kind of ripping off of it and just changing things here and there, some people have the impression that, well, that kind of delegitimizes the account in Genesis. I mean, I don't think that's really what happened in the end, but even if it were that way, I don't think that would take anything away from Genesis. Genesis, like any other work, is a product of its age. It's going to be filled with all of the idioms, all of the language, all of the culture, and so on, that you would expect it to be full of, because of its time in history, and because of the kind of literature that it was. Of course it's going to use language that's typical for ancient Near Eastern myths, if it's an ancient Near Eastern myth, right, if that's what it's doing. And if you look at Genesis through that lens, this is something Pope Benedict actually does really well. He has a book called In the Beginning, and he does an analysis on this where if you look carefully at Genesis through that lens, you can actually see that not only is it using a lot of typical ancient Near Eastern mythic tropes and so on, it's also transforming them in some ways, or moving around them in some ways. So if you read the Enuma Elish, it's very hard to go through that and not realize that there are multiple gods, there's a whole drama between the gods, there's a struggle and so on. You can't read Genesis and get anything like the impression that there are other gods or that there's any struggle going on. God simply says it and it's done. That's it. And in fact, Genesis is interesting because it'll even avoid, a lot of people don't realize, the word sun never appears in the creation narrative. The word moon never appears. Because these words in Hebrew very likely have etymological roots, or linguistic roots, in names that might have been used by other people, not only for a sun, right? They would have similar words for a sun, similar words for a moon, but they would also deify them, right? So they would say, well, there's a god, the sun god. Well, what are we going to call that? Let's call it the sun, right? Whatever word we have for the sun. So the author of Genesis actually never uses the word sun in the creation account. In fact, it's avoided until
chapters later. I think chapter 15 is the first time in Genesis when the Hebrew word for sun, which is shemesh, I think, that's the word that you will not find that in Genesis. Instead, Genesis just says there was a big light, and then there was a smaller light, and then there are little lights. So it refers to the lights and even avoids using the words that could be confused into thinking, well, maybe this is implying that there are these other deities and God's the one creating them. No, no. It avoids using even words that might have that implication. So if you look at Genesis through that lens, in a sense, you actually can see Genesis contrasting with other ancient Near Eastern myths in a way that highlights that God is unique. Right? That many people read Genesis as not merely henotheistic, which means you just have a strong preference for your God and you don't care about the others, but legitimately monotheistic. This is the only God. There is no other God that's part of the story. There's no struggle between one God and another God or some council of gods. There's nothing like that in Genesis. So it's taking a lot of those ancient Near Eastern motifs and then it's casting them in a way that isn't done in the other ancient Near Eastern myths. It's like it's taking that kind of literature and reorienting all of it to be clearly monotheistic, to put all of the focus on God. And I think that way of reading Genesis is historically attentive. I think that's the right kind of way to approach it. But it also helps highlight those ways in which Genesis contrasts with the myths of its age. So even if you view it as mythic literature or mytho-history, as I think we should, even then you can see that none of this makes Genesis look bad. It actually makes Genesis look pretty good, because by contrast to other ancient Near Eastern myths, you can see the similarities in the way that they're thinking, and then you can see the clear points of difference, where Genesis is just in a completely different category from other stories of the same kind. So I think that helps us to frame the way to look at Genesis. This is the other big question, though, with respect to Genesis. You have to ask, who wrote it?
Yes.
Who wrote it? Exactly. When? And were there, you know, did it, so traditionally the view is that the whole of what we call the Torah, or the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, were written by, or substantially originate with, Moses. So perhaps Moses didn't write the entirety of the Pentateuch, meaning the five books, or what Jews just call the Torah. Maybe he didn't write the entire thing, because of course it does talk about his death and then what happened just after his death, and so it looks like he probably couldn't have written that. A lot of parts of the Torah talk about Moses in third person, so it looks like, okay, well maybe he wrote that, but probably not. But still, if you think that it, in the main, the Torah, the first five books, come from as far back as Moses, that's going to significantly change the context against which you're looking at Genesis to compare it to other contemporary literature. You're not going to be looking to the 9th century BC, the 6th century BC, and so on. You're going to be looking all the way back at Moses' day, and you're going to be looking at similarities and differences between that and the surrounding ancient Near Eastern literature at that time. So where you date Genesis and whether you think it is Mosaic or not is significantly going to change how you approach interpreting the text. And this is something that I think a lot of Christians run into when, and oftentimes this is never really talked about outside of academia. So when Christians go to study at the university, and they encounter scholars saying that, well, Moses never wrote any of Genesis, right? He never wrote anything in the entire Torah, and we're quite sure about that. A lot of times people get taken aback, and they say, well, wait, really? Do we really know that? And there are a lot of people, including many Catholics, who have taken this theory. This theory is actually referred to as the documentary hypothesis. And this is a theory that kind of breaks down not just Genesis, but all five of the first books, and tries to say, well, okay, it's very likely there wasn't just one author. We can actually discern four different strands in here. So maybe there were four different authors. One we're going to call, that usually we refer to them as J-D-E-P. Yeah? Yeah.
It's separated to break in.
Yeah.
You commented, if I heard you right, that how you interpret Genesis depends on what time frame you're taking your context.
When you date it to, yeah. Yeah.
And why? Can you give me an example? Because when I look at Genesis, you have to ask, what was so important about Genesis that Moses decided it should be part of the story?
Right. Right.
And if I look at it and quickly say, what are the key lessons? One, there is a God,
mm-hmm.
and he created the world. Whether I'm in the 6th century, 4th BC, now, that lesson doesn't, that interpretation doesn't change. There
right.
is a God, he created the world.
Right.
Later, we see man being created.
Yep.
All of man originates from Adam and Eve. That's the next big lesson.
Mm-hmm.
The third big one, it was the original sin, which kind of led to everything else.
Right.
But those three lessons, I would say, are independent. The interpretation is independent of what time you're in.
Yes.
Looking at that. So what do you mean by difference
okay.
in interpretation?
So I was thinking of avoiding this, but we can't really avoid
oh.
it. There is a technical distinction the scholars make between what's
okay.
called lower criticism
right.
and higher criticism. Lower criticism is just interested in what you can get out of the text by looking at the text. You
right.
want to know, looking at the text, looking at the structure, looking at the language, looking at what it says, what can you get out of this text without reference to anything outside?
Sure.
Higher criticism, though, wants to take a step back and say, okay, how do we situate this text, even historically? Who was most likely the author? In what period or in what area was it written in? What were the politics of that time? And higher critics will say, look, if we can gain insights like that, we can very likely not only gain insight into what the author is trying to do, plausibly, but we can gain insights into what the original audience was intended to see in the text, which that original author would have known, right? So to give an example, to go to apocalyptic literature, let's say, if you dated Revelation, the book of Revelation, significantly differently, or if you approached it very differently, you might come away with a very different interpretation. But a traditional interpretation that recognizes that it was composed roughly around the end of that first century AD would say that when it refers to the beast and it gives his number as 666, or some actually say 616, that is almost certainly a reference to Caesar Augustus Nero, who, if you take his name and translate it using Hebrew gematria, you get the value 666. Or if you just do, I think it's Caesar Nero, without the Augustus, you get 616. Well, if you date Revelation significantly differently from how you would normally date it, you might not think, that wouldn't have been in the political atmosphere at the time, right? It makes sense for somebody to talk about Nero in that way within the first century, especially somebody from the Christian community. But it stops making as much sense to do that if it was written, suppose it were written, nobody thinks this, but suppose it were written in like the 12th century. Okay, that significantly changes what the author is very likely trying to do, right?
Right, so my question, I pointed to three lessons of Genesis.
Yeah.
What you're saying is by understanding the context of the author, there may be more that you can pull out.
Exactly. Okay, yes, and this is actually a good point, because there are arguments that Catholics or Christians generally have about things like the documentary hypothesis and how we approach Genesis, how we interpret it. A lot of those debates are not about the essentials. just like we saw last time, when there are non-essential disagreements, even if they're substantial in some ways, these would be maybe substantial disagreements, but not essentials. You can be a Catholic and adopt the documentary hypothesis and say, Moses wrote none of the Torah. I think this is wrong, but you can say this. And it's still perfectly, you can still work out all of the doctrinal tenets. You can work out original sin. You can work out everything from the text. You can still work it out. But you're going to end up, I think, further down the line with some very significant problems. You're going to end up not reading all parts of the first five books of the Bible equally. And I think you're actually going to end up reading even the prophets very differently. Because the influence of how you date different sections of Genesis is going to pour over into how you date sections of the prophets. If parts of Isaiah, for example, start using language that sounds a lot like this part of the Torah, and you've already found that that part might have been written by an author centuries later, maybe even centuries later than Isaiah is alleged to have lived. So there's a kind of domino effect here if you do accept something like the documentary hypothesis. That doesn't mean that you can't go down that road. A lot of people do go down that road. And it's in some ways, it's a respectable thing, because even though a lot of people take the documentary hypothesis to be a challenge to their faith, in a lot of ways, first of all, it doesn't challenge the essentials, right, as you were just pointing out. But it's also, it needn't erode faith in any deep or significant way because it doesn't touch the essentials. And it really does affect how you interpret certain passages, but it doesn't lock you in necessarily to interpreting passages one way or another. But it is going to, and it is good to take inventory of this, it's going to highly incline you to one set of interpretations or another. So in some sense, you ought to take a step back and say, okay, what do I think is most plausible about the authorship? What do I think is most plausible about when it was written? What do I think is most plausible about the surrounding culture at the time in which it was written? Because how you answer those questions is going to spill out into what deeper insights you're likely to think are spurious or very legitimate. Right? So that's the reason people care about things like the documentary.
Have not the rabbis and the Catholic popes dated these things? I mean, is that not studied and recorded somewhere as to when all of this has been happening?
Okay, so yes and no. Yes, there are traditionally ascribed dates, but the traditionally ascribed date for the first five books, for example, puts it all the way back to the time of Moses. The documentary hypothesis, which is comparatively new, suggests a complete overhaul of that traditional dating that's agreed upon by Jewish rabbis and their traditions, as well as Catholic traditions. And so the documentary hypothesis kind of intends to explode that and say, no, that's the wrong way of looking at this. We have, I wrote on the board because I wanted to use it. But this is just to make it a bit easier to see. So if you look at the documentary hypothesis, you can actually divide up, and this is what the documentary hypothesis does. It divides up the alleged authors of different parts of not just Genesis, but throughout the first five books, according to these four anonymous sources. So who are they? We don't really know. We'll call them J, E, D, and P. So these are not scholars of bad name. So J is supposed to be the Yahwist. It's the one who uses the name of God revealed to Moses, the burning bush, I am that I am. This is the author who is most likely using that word. E, by contrast, is the author who is more sections of Genesis, you'll see it just uses one term over and over and over. And then you go to another section of Genesis and it uses the other term over and over and over and over. And then you go to another section and it seems to do a different thing. So this is the standard division now of the documentary hypothesis. It will divide this into the Deuteronomist is the third author, and then the priestly source is the priestly source. Priests, yeah. And so these are the ones who liturgicalize everything and put things in context with the temple and so on, according to this division. And if you go deeper, you'll find that these are typically dated very, very differently, right? So you find the Yahwist is around the 950 BC, you find the Elohist is 900 to 800, roughly. You find the Deuteronomist is from 800 to 600, and then the priestly source is the one closest to the time of Christ, the latest one, is 500 to 400. And then what some people do is they'll say, well, these are the four sources, but there must also have been a redactor, somebody who takes them all and puts all of these things together to get the jumble of what we call the Torah. And that's going to include what we call Genesis. That's why Genesis looks the way it does, according to this theory. I think some people would say that the priestly class might be the redactors, but I think standardly the documentary hypothesis will just say there is an additional redactor who goes through and tries to harmonize and put all these things together. This is actually a little bit funny though, because the documentary hypothesis in this form comes from somebody named Julius Wellhausen. So this is like later 19th century. But before him, there was a scholar, I've forgotten his name, he's another German scholar, I think his name is Auerbach, something like that. Don't trust me on that, I'll have to actually look that up. But he had a similar inclination, except without these dates at all. He thought J, E, D, and P, or something like that, were really, really ancient, and that the redactor who put them all together was Moses. And that's why we still should consider Moses the author. Well, okay, again, these are very, very different ways of dating these different sections, and it's really going to influence what you make of the text, how you're more likely to interpret it. But if you take the documentary hypothesis in this form seriously, look how far off that is from Moses. It is not close. Moses is 1391 to 1271 BC. This is all well, well after that time. So if you buy into this, not only will you say that Moses didn't author any of it, you're going to say that there's very little influence from Moses himself to any of this, right? And this is why I think people get a little bit tripped up when they first go to university, they first encounter this theologically, and they see a lot of scholars talking as though this is just absolutely established fact. Now, for a very long time, and I mean, academically speaking, if there is any theological theory that commands the consensus of scholarship for a significant amount of time, it deserves some respect. So I'm not trying to say there's absolutely nothing to this, or we should throw it out, or it's all wrong, but I do think that as significant as the arguments can be for this, I do think there are serious problems. There are various parts in the Torah, even in Genesis, where if you're going to start dividing things this way, it looks like the first half of the verse must have been from the J, and then the second half must have been from E, and then a few words in must be from D, and then you get P, and then it's back to J. And it's like, that was one sentence. Are we really going to start dividing things up this way? It just doesn't look right. It looks more reasonable to say that maybe there are inclinations when you're talking about certain things to prefer using the term Elohim, or to prefer using the name of God, or to prefer something else, right? Maybe you have a different emphasis. Maybe if you're speaking liturgically, you're going to use language that sounds more liturgical. So it could be that these are entirely different sources, or it could be that whoever the author is, if it's Mosaic especially, there is just a different tendency at different points in the literature to use some terms over others, or to put some emphasis instead of other points of emphasis. So a lot of this stuff is now being severely questioned. This dating is now being severely questioned. So if you go to university now and learn about this, people will say this is almost certain, but not necessarily certain. We're still revising it and But if you had gone like 10 years ago, it was like, no, this is certain. If you don't, I actually did something where I had a professor who said that this was basically certain, and he was teaching a whole class on this basis. And we had the ability to write whatever paper we wanted. So I did a research paper arguing that this is wrong, and he let me write it. We actually got along really well, but I just looked at all of the arguments for it and against it, and I thought, look, it's not like I'm being dismissive of the arguments for it. It's just that I don't think they're strong enough. I think people imagine them to be much stronger than they are because they construct, almost like constructing castles in your head. You can make a lot of sense of things like this, and then wherever there are problems, you kind of gloss over those problems. Oh, that's not such a big problem. There are increasingly problems with this view. And I think not just theologically, but even just from the perspective of higher criticism, there are real problems with this kind of approach to it.
Would you say it's easier to, if you describe it to Moses, it's easier to buy into divine inspiration than it is for anonymous authors who you don't know where or when they came from?
And the time frame between Moses and the JEDP is very significant.
It's huge, So that's why,
Well, why do so many people think that Moses, like, I don't really know that much about it, so maybe this is basic information. Why do so many people think that Moses wrote the Bible then?
Right, so the first five books? Because there are so many books after that that continually refer back to Moses, or what Moses wrote, and it's constantly referring to those first five books. And so you see that throughout the prophets, and then you see that even in the New Testament. It just goes unquestioned in the New Testament when people are talking to Jesus, or sometimes when Jesus is talking, they just refer to Moses. Moses said, Moses wrote, Moses, okay, well, was it Moses or not? Now, you could make an argument that, well, that was just a kind of turn of phrase that it refers to, well, Moses wrote, but they didn't really mean that Moses necessarily literally wrote it. I can be pretty charitable to stuff like that. I can allow that you can make an argument like that, but there's no way to make an argument that that wasn't the obvious presumption of the people at the time. They presumed that Moses was the one who substantially wrote it. And there are plenty of, even in the Jewish rabbinic tradition, there are rabbis who say, okay, maybe he didn't write that section about his death and afterwards. Like, he doesn't need to have written every single word. But substantially, it was always taken traditionally to have come from Moses. And again, whether you think it really does come from him or really doesn't come at all from him is going to change how you think about the text, how you approach it, how you interpret it, what other, there are some things from the text you're going to get from the text no matter what, like you were saying. You can get from the text no matter when you date it. But how you date it and what you think the background is will significantly change how you think about the text, what other ancient Near Eastern texts you're going to compare it to for contrast, which ones you think were earlier. Because if this is early enough, maybe this influenced the other ancient Near Eastern myths that you're comparing it to. So instead of saying Genesis mutated the tradition and did something that was more monotheistic, maybe it didn't, right? Maybe these others mutated the more monotheistic tradition and made it more polytheistic. Well, which one you think is right is going to depend a lot on how you date, on how you think about this theory. So this, I only bring this up because, again, outside of something like an apologetics context, people do not hear about this stuff. And then they go to a university or they encounter somebody who is a scholar, and people will say things like, well, this is just absolutely true. And first of all, it's not. Almost nothing in scholarship in these areas is absolutely true or unquestionable or anything like that. But this has enjoyed basic consensus for a very long time, and it is now starting to crack at the seams. Scholars are really starting to look at it. And part of that is also because some scholars have tried the same strategy with completely different books. So they've used it for the Gospel of John, and you end up with like three different authors and then three different dates, and it just starts looking like, really? That doesn't look right anymore. But you're using the same basic methodology as you did here. So defenders of the documentary hypothesis will say, well, maybe it doesn't work everywhere because it's not true everywhere, but it works here. And others will say, yeah, maybe it doesn't work here, and that's why it doesn't work other places so well either. And you guys have been ignoring a lot of the problems and glossing over them. So maybe we should just scrap this or start over, something like that. So
does not the thought that Genesis was like 6,000 years ago?
There's not the thought that Genesis was written 6,000 years ago?
No, but that those incidences occurred 6,000 years ago.
Right. Yes, but then if you think so, at that point it doesn't matter where you date the author.
Yeah.
If they're not there witnessing the creation event or something like
that,
they're clearly Genesis not written as eyewitness history or anything like that. Even if you thought it was more historical rather than mythic literature, it's clearly not anything like an eyewitness account in the way that the Gospels could be. But that's not going to change anything theologically necessarily. If Moses was delivering something that was legitimate revelation, right? If God was revealing himself through Moses, then I think we should be inclined to say that that is, it's true. And the reason we can reliably think that it's true is that it's still coming from God. So the reliable source is just God himself speaking through Moses. That would still be true if it was J-E-D-P instead of Moses, right? If J-E-D-P are all being inspired, the same way that you might allege that Moses is being inspired, you can still have a doctrine of inspiration either way, right? And that's why I say it's not like you cannot accept the documentary hypothesis as a Catholic. It's just that, number one, it's not as certain as people pretend it is. There are a lot of problems with it. And number two, a lot of people accept this. Well, okay, people react differently to it. First, some people encounter this, get blown away by it, and then it erodes their faith in a way that I think is not really appropriate, because if you think it through, it doesn't affect any of the essentials. It will affect how you're going to approach the text in some important ways, but that's really still a matter open to interpretation. But I think we should take this as an interesting theory that even if it were true, wouldn't overturn any essential article of the faith. But we have good reasons, if we take the faith seriously, to be at least highly suspicious of this, in a way that if you're a naturalist, for example, you might not have the same reasons for being as suspicious of it. In fact, a lot of the assumptions that go into the way the documentary hypothesis is argued are explicitly naturalistic assumptions. And they make assumptions about the kind of evolution or the natural evolution of religion over time, that just assumes that Genesis cannot have been strictly monotheistic, where the ancient Israelites, certainly this far back, could not have been really monotheistic. They must have been polytheistic, and maybe they developed what I called earlier henotheism, right? The view that we prefer our God is the best, rah-rah, but there are others, but we're just going to ignore them, right? The documentary hypothesis kind of almost presumes, well, that was the natural progression of things, that you've got polytheism first, and then people start focusing in on their particular people's God or their particular tribe's God, and then eventually you can get all the way to monotheism. But because it suggests that, and it suggests monotheism couldn't be this old, well, then you're going to look at Genesis differently, and you're going to, I mean, there are a number of ways in which you're going to interpret it. Like when you see in the first account of Genesis where God says, let us make man in our own image, right? A lot of Christians will take that and say, well, that's almost a kind of Trinitarian or an evidence for the Trinity, because God is speaking to who? He's speaking to himself, right? And he's saying, let us, me plural, let us make man in our own image. Well, that can look like some evidence for the Trinity, but if you're to interpret it a way that is closer in line with the documentary hypothesis, that's kind of a literary clue, a little crumb that's been left behind, that actually it was polytheistic all along. And the other gods that he's talking to have just kind of been written out here and there. Well, again, which way you go is going to change significantly how you start looking at the text. Yeah?
Who developed the documentary hypothesis?
Sorry? Who developed
it? Who developed
it? So it was, okay, so the person to whom it's usually attributed is Julius Wellhausen, like I said.
And
but, yeah.
He's an atheist,
Good question. No, so he's a German scholar. I believe that he was, I don't know if we should call him a naturalist. I'll have to look this up. If I'm mistaken about this, I'll correct myself later, but he at least had a strong, almost anti-supernaturalist view. So what I mean by that is not necessarily a commitment to atheism or naturalism,
right,
but a commitment at least to pushing supernatural explanations out. You can't consider them. They have to be foreboding, right? You don't use those explanations when you're doing serious scholarship. And so the way he's approaching these texts is on a number of presumptions, including a kind of very common evolutionary, what's called an evolutionary presumption, about the way that religions, ancient religions,
mm-hmm.
evolve from this early polytheism onwards. And so he would have gone along with all of that. And that, if you take that view, or even think that view is plausible, you're going to think that this is more plausible. Whereas if you think, no, Genesis really looks strikingly monotheistic, right? And there's almost no way of missing that if you're reading it carefully. Well, then you're going to be more inclined to think we can place monotheism further back, right? At least this far back.
And
if not...
Yeah, when did he develop this?
When did he develop this?
Yeah.
So this is 19th century, roughly.
So fairly recent.
Fairly recent, that's right. This is a very modern theory in higher criticism.
And he may have had his own agenda.
Yes, people have pointed that out. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
They could have herded us all
right
into believing this.
Yep.
Because
yep.
that's what they wanted.
Yes, right. It could be. There are very strong motivations here for not only traditional Jews and Christians to affirm Mosaic authorship. There are also very strong motivations on this end, right? So it's not like the people arguing for the documentary hypothesis are doing it in a value-neutral way or a philosophically neutral way. No, that's nonsense. Nothing like that is true. This is very highly motivated by a highly critical approach that takes a certain view of religion that is, I think, naturalistic or anti-supernaturalist, something like that. So it is, and this is why I'm doing this, because even though this seems very boring, and it is boring relative to most of what we do, but this is important because if people run into this, and they do this all the time, and they've never heard of it before, they've never thought of it before, then it can be a serious challenge. I've seen it be a serious challenge to people's faith, when I think it doesn't have to be. Both because, even if we granted all of this for the sake of argument, it doesn't take away any of the essentials. It doesn't challenge anything that's essential to the faith. You can still go back and say, well, okay, the prophets will refer to it as Moses, but maybe there's some the trickle-down effect where Moses is still influencing all of this, and this is, still Mosaic tradition or something like that. You can say stuff like that. It doesn't mean that JEDP weren't inspired. It doesn't mean, and of course, the point I was making before, and this is what made me laugh when I was writing that paper and found this out, there's a scholar earlier than Wellhausen that comes up with this division of the text without these dates, and then says, yeah, there were these divisions, and Moses is the one who puts them together. So if you think Moses is the one, so basically he plagiarized and then changed the dates, but if you go back to Moses and say, well, he's the redactor, he's the one that puts all this together, it starts to look like, well, you can just retain Mosaic authorship. And it's funny because the whole point of dividing it up between these four sources is that the four sources are supposed to be completely different. They're at odds with each other, they think differently, maybe they even contradict each other. But then the theory also suggests that on the end, right, when we actually get the five books as we get them come down to us today, an editor went through and harmonized the entire thing. Well, you can't have both of those be true. An editor didn't go through and harmonize the entire thing, and it's still completely full of obvious contradictions that nobody could have put together. At least whoever this editor was has to have thought there wasn't a serious contradiction, because they put it in saying, this is fine, you can put these two things together. Now, people will sometimes talk about contradictions, like contradictions in the flood narrative, where if you look carefully, you'll see actually they aren't really contradictions. Even in Genesis, right? So it's got a six-day creation scheme, and then God rests on the seventh day, and then what does chapter 2 say? In the one day that God created the heavens and the earth, 2 is a different creation story than chapter 1. Well, okay, maybe. Or maybe whoever the editor was didn't see a contradiction between those two. And if an editor sees no contradiction between those two, why couldn't an author not see any contradiction between those two? It just seems like an open question whether you think an editor put them together and he was sufficiently satisfied that this is not contradictory, or whether it's an author who puts together different oral traditions and says, yeah, I can put these together. There's no contradiction here if you understand what I'm trying to say.
That still is just humans that
yes.
have taken all of this information, put it together, and have agreed.
Yes.
This is what it is.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
And we
and it,
just believe it.
That's right. And this is the thing. It's worth recognizing that this is a theory. And that's why, even though I don't want to be dismissive of it, even though I think the amount of ink that's been spilled in defense of this as a theory is significant, I don't want to say that somebody who subscribes to this theory is stupid or anything like that, but I think that they exaggerate the extent to which they can be confident in this theory. Theories like this typically go in and out of fashion for a plethora of different reasons, and it happens all the time. What makes the documentary hypothesis special? Well, there are a few things that make it special. First, it has lasted so long. It has commanded a significant consensus in scholarship for a very long time. So it's worth recognizing that. Second, documentary hypothesis seems to be just about the first 5 books. But in many ways, this is not just about the first 5 books. This ends up being about how you read the entirety of the Old Testament, because it changes how you're going to date the prophets. It changes whether you think Isaiah has 1 author, 2 authors, 3 authors, how you date those 3 authors. It's going to change how you think about plenty of the books in the Old Testament. And so if you subscribe to this, and then you go from the first 5 books to all the rest of the books in the Old Testament, you're going to be looking at those books very differently than you would have done if you started here. And you can see that increasingly in scholarship, where people who have adopted this view are increasingly diverging from the scholars who start with this assumption and then work their way into the other books of the Old Testament. So those two things make the documentary hypothesis special. It has commanded the assent of scholarship for so long that not all scholars, obviously, but a significant majority for a very long time. And it has this trickle-down effect where it will change how you're likely to look at a number of other books in the Old Testament. It'll change how you're looking at them. It may not change anything that is really core, really theologically at the center. You can hold theologically core things like original sin, whatever you think about this. But I do think that this is, first, I think that it's mistaken. I think that it is much more plausible that if you have an editor who can put all this together, you can have an author who puts these things together as oral traditions. I don't see why that's incredibly implausible. And it's very hard to believe, for me, that the universal view of the ancient Jews across all literature and all of their traditions would ascribe all of this to Moses if it didn't actually come from Moses. Why, if Moses didn't write it, if it comes from these 4 different sources, how in the world do you get everybody to say, no, it came from Moses? You can imagine some people saying that, but everybody saying that, and everybody understanding that that's part of their history, it's not impossible. It just seems to me highly implausible. If the people who were there reading the book at the time, as far as their tradition goes, all say, yeah, we got this from Moses, I think we should give that some level of credence. And if the argument for saying it couldn't have been Moses is, well, obviously monotheism couldn't have been this old, well, if God's revealing himself to Moses, yes, monotheism could definitely have been that old, right? Or if somebody says, well, it can't have been one author, it has to have been put together by an editor who's using these different sources, well, why couldn't Moses be putting together oral traditions? Why couldn't Moses even be putting together literary traditions if he had them at hand? There's no argument you can make for an editor of these four sources that doesn't then just translate pretty easily to that could have been Moses, or that could have been an original author. So this is what I tried to argue in that paper a long time ago, is that basically any of the arguments you have for an editor smoothing things over can be translated into an argument for thinking it was just Moses in the first place. And that was the original theory before Julius Wellhausen picked it up and changed it and added these, roughly speaking, added these dates to the different sources, right, that were far, far, far after Moses' time.
So these are sources, different sources for the Old Testament,
for the first five books.
Okay, for the Torah.
Yes.
Okay. And you really need to read the Torah in the context of Jewish tradition. So you have four sources for scripture, but is it all interpreted against, how's that reconciled with Jewish tradition? Do you have an equal number of breakdowns of, like, you have four separate Jewish traditions
right
now that follow that?
Right. So because of the way that they've dated them, the priestly source is the last one, and they're the ones that sort of set this in stone as this is the tradition, and this is going to inform not only how we worship and how we believe, how we structure our lives as a community. So this source, the last one, the latest one, or the editor who puts it all together afterwards at very latest, is going to be the source of all of that tradition. So on this view, the documentary hypothesis, it's not like you got Moses and then this Mosaic tradition flows from that time. No, no. Moses may not have even existed, but even if he did, he probably had almost nothing to do with these guys. And these guys are, right down to the priestly source, just giving us different accounts. And the priestly source is the one that says, well, okay, let's put this into not only laws, Deuteronomist gives us laws, but actually make this the framework with which we're going to live, and tell people that all of this comes from Moses. And you're telling people this late that all of this comes from Moses. And everybody's got to believe it. Everybody's got to buy it. There's no dissenting view on it.
So things like the Midrash,
yes,
comes from the priestly, supposedly comes from the priestly.
Yeah, well, because, yeah, but the Midrash are going to be, we don't have any Midrash that go this far back as far as our records go. Right, the Midrash is going to be something that you can go as far back as like the 2nd century AD. Even though the traditions are alleged to be older, the sources we have that say those traditions are older are only from the 2nd century. The Talmud is very old in terms of the traditions that it testifies to, but the Talmud, as far as we have it, as far as we can actually look at manuscripts and so on, is going to be 4th to 5th century. It's long after the New Testament, even if the traditions predate the New Testament. But then you can always come in and say, well, since we don't have any copies of this that go that far back, maybe there was significant mutation over time. Do we really know whether there was? Now, according to any Orthodox Jew, no. But according to a scholar who thinks this is plausible, yeah, why not? Of course it could be that way. Of course, maybe this far back, nobody's even talking about Moses. And then over here with the priestly source, all of a sudden, everyone thinks all of this is just Moses' handiwork, right? Because that's what the priestly class is telling all of the people. You can also see a certain view of society and criticisms of religion in general in Wellhausen's view. I mean, it's pretty clear, I think. And that's one way that you might go about poking holes at it, because clearly it was psychologically attractive to people in our time, right, in modernity, in a way that would have, ancient people might have thought that looked ridiculous. Like, no, of course we wouldn't all just believe that because the priests say so. Where did the priestly class come from if they weren't established by somebody, right? And they should have been established way, way back from Moses. Yeah.
Yeah, I find it interesting this mechanism by which the JEDP theory kind of claims to have established itself as power, like, or like how Homo say authorship was established according to the theory.
Yeah.
It's a conspiracy theory almost a little bit. You know, in the sense that like a small group of people got together and you know, we're gonna set this up.
Yeah.
Everyone's gonna believe it.
Yeah.
It's a little conspiratorial.
There is, well, legitimately, yes, it is a little bit conspiratorial. If none of this comes from Moses and you conspire to make everyone else believe that this comes from, it's literally a conspiracy theory. And I'm not saying that pejoratively, that's literally what the kind of thing that it is. But I think, again, I don't want to be dismissive. I don't want to act like there are no arguments for it. And I would prefer that people take it a little bit more seriously rather than just dismissing it. Because it's only once you start taking it seriously that you're going to navigate around it or be able to find the holes in the theory and the problems with it. And a lot of people who subscribe to this view just gloss over or imagine that there are no problems. No, there really are problems. There are some passages where there's this nice cut, you know, Genesis 1 to Genesis 2, and maybe you can argue there are two creation accounts, but there are plenty of other places where if you're looking at authorship divided in this way, all four just get jumbled up, and then you say, oh, well, the editor put them together. Okay, well, why couldn't just an author have done that? And do you really need this theory if clumps of texts are just full of all four of them, or three of them, or something like that, right?
Well, Gilgamesh, was that not written at the time of the Sumerians? I mean, there's not like thousands of years later, like with Moses, mm-hmm. where, you know, the stories are put down on paper. Gilgamesh was exactly in the time.
Well, yeah, so as far as we know. Now, this is, to some extent, you're going to have to do good textual criticism and historical criticism even on that, but for the Epic of Gilgamesh, as well as many other ancient texts, we don't have the kind of manuscript evidence that we could use, the same way that we have for Bata. I mean, there's nothing even close to the kind of level of the volume of manuscripts that we have of the Bible in different languages and different regions, that we can be a lot more confident of a lot of things in the Bible and in its original authorship than we can for most other ancient texts. But yes, yeah, our best guess, and it's a reasonable guess, is the Epic of Gilgamesh, we can reconstruct what it very likely looked like in its original form, yeah.
But can I say, like, I was wondering, why would I guess that it was so much later than Moses? Like, wouldn't like the main reason to be back it up be like, oh, because the things that they were saying were more modern, so it must have been placed in that time period, sort of? Because it's like a big gap.
It is a big gap. It is a big gap. Okay, without getting into too many details, I can maybe just make this not even two reasons, but one. If you look at the politics of these different periods, and you think, okay, well, if you restructure Israel's history as a nomadic tribe going through the desert, and you think about what they would have been like on the kind of naturalistic assumption, Moses didn't have a huge influence. I mean, he's a well-known figure, but not the kind of influence the tradition ascribes to him. What would the emphasis look like while they're still a completely nomadic tribe? What would the emphasis start to look like as they start to write extensive laws? What would the emphasis start to look like as they form a priestly class that wants to get everyone worshiping the same way, integrated in society the same way? If you have this view, then your motivation for dating these periods is partly going to be what you assume Israel would have been like on this assumption about their real history. They start off as these nomads who are polytheists, and then slowly over time they grow into the Israelites that we know, right? The Jews that we know, and they form those traditions. But you need some kind of progression. You need some story to tell. And this kind of frames what that story looks like. And it's completely different from the story that you would get if you just read the Torah at face value. If you read those first five books and you looked at how Israel thought about itself and its identity and its history and the surrounding peoples and so on, and they think of themselves as the chosen people of God, that God made a covenant with them through Moses and so on, their view of themselves is going to be completely different from what this suggests they actually went through. But the dating here is based on that presumption, that there has to have been this, when you see an emphasis for the temple, right? Well, okay, now they're settling down. They're not taking a tent everywhere and worshiping in it.
Right.
They found a place and settled down. When you start seeing more references to things that look like they're talking about a king, well, now you have more structure in society. So maybe that comes later, right? You see, like that's the kind of logic that they're going to use to give these dates. And these are very rough, right? And some scholars will play around with these too. But this is roughly what they think.
Are there any writings from Abraham?
No. From Abraham himself?
Yeah.
No.
So
certainly none.
This is word of mouth that's been passed down
through
the centuries. And
yes.
And Moses finally put it all together.
Well, yeah, according to this.
Yeah.
According to this view, yes, Moses is the one who would have put it together.
That's
the traditional view.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay. And so it's still plausible that Moses would have been working with traditions that he received,
mm-hmm.
right? Oral traditions or otherwise. And it's just that he's the one putting them together. Whereas, on this view, no. Those are not even received traditions necessarily. They're developed traditions
mm-hmm.
that you convince people actually come from Moses or much further back. Okay. All right. Are there any, I wonder if we should maybe take a quick break and then come back. Before we go to a break, putting this aside, are there any other questions, or even about this, are there any questions about how to approach Genesis or what you guys think about Genesis? Again, completely not with respect to how to put it together with science, but just looking at the text itself and questions that come up from studying the text.
I think there's been a lot left out. What about the Book of Enoch?
Right, okay. So that's much, much later. Much, much later. But it's a good question. So the Book of Enoch comes centuries and centuries later. Virtually everyone agrees that it wasn't really written by Enoch. And it is a really interesting, really, really interesting book.
Yeah.
But it's not just Enoch, actually. There are a lot of books that are called pseudepigraphal. They're called pseudepigraphal, which is just a fancy way of saying you don't really know who the author is. So they're pseudepigraphal books, and they come from the Jews, and they're not included in the Old Testament at all, but they're just all over the place. They have completely different views, completely different emphasis, and you can also see how they have different political views as well, right? If you read between the lines and you know how to date those texts. There's a lot in that literature that's really, it's revealing of the range of views that the Jews had. I mean, you can say the same thing about things like the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's a range of views that you see among the Essenes that gives you a sense for what Jews at the time thought, right? And what things would have been unthinkable for them, like a Messiah dying and rising again from the dead. It's just unthinkable to them, as much as they were willing to go around and think, well, maybe the Messiah is actually two people, and still it would have been completely different. But yes, there's a lot of stuff in the pseudepigrapha that's highly interesting. It gives us insight into what the Jews thought, but it doesn't give us insight into what Jews this long ago thought. And it doesn't even give us insight into what Jews this long ago thought. It would give us insight into basically what Jews in what some people refer to as an intertestamental period. Although that's a bit of a misnomer, I don't like using that term, but say from 400, maybe, from 400 BC to 33 AD, let's just say. Probably goes a little bit later than that. You probably get to the end of the first century and still have pseudepigrapha being written, but like roughly in that period, it gives you at least a sense of what Jews at the time thought and what the landscape looked like. But it's not like it was left out. It was really a completely different kind of writing, right? Like when people in the second century wrote gospels or things that we refer to as gospels, they weren't left out. They were just never even considered. It wasn't even on the table for anyone to think of those as being legitimate. They were obviously much later, and they didn't have the kind of sway over early Christian communities that the early Gospels did. Right? Anybody else? Before
before we go to a break? Okay, so we'll go for a quick break and then come back.